wanted to jump on here and kind of talk about something I had posted. I'm going to try to rip through this pretty quickly and try to do it in one take. Usually I do, but trying to make it to where I don't have to edit very much right now. I just don't have the time. I'm burning the candle at both ends lately. I'm sure a lot of you are, especially right now with the way the economy's going and how much overtime everybody's working and things like that. So it's 10:42 where I'm at. It's just not stopping. Still got a bunch of stuff to get done. I got to record this, got to edit this, post it. Oh, all that stuff. You know how it goes. Anyways, let's talk about something that happened to me the other day. One of those things was I posted, just said, you ever have just an off day? It was one of those for me. And then I put, so if everyone can just F the right off, that'd be great. And that's another thing. I think I'm getting sick too. At first, this post didn't do very well. It was restricted, I think, because of what I typed, and ended up going out to several hundred people. And I just wanted to talk about it. And realistically, what it came down to was it was just a bout of depression. And fortunately for me, I don't deal with this a lot. At least I don't think I do. But it was just, it was one of those things, man. I was in a mood. Again, it doesn't happen often, not lately. Again, as you know, I'm out of EMS, and so I'm actually out of the medical field. Well, not really. But for the most part, I don't practice anything. I don't have patients or nothing like that. So, but what got me thinking was why? Why do we get this way? And the only thing I can come up with is survivor's guilt. Sorry. But it how do we have survivor's guilt? We're not there when it happens. And typically we're not attached to the person who's dying or died. So it's weird, but for those who might be new or just living under a rock and don't know what survivor guilt is, it's explained, according to the Cambridge Dictionary, as a difficult and painful feelings caused by the fact that you are still alive after a situation in which other people died. That's every single day in EMS, man. Well, not every day. I wouldn't say we run dead bodies every single day, but, man, I've talked about it before. There was a time in when I worked in L.A. that, on a box, we were running, I know we ran a full arrest every 8 calendar days. I've said this before, it's every 8 calendar days, which worked out to every third or fourth shift. And so we did that for months on end, and it wasn't uncommon. And I've said it before, where we go into work, you know, typically with EMS and fire and medical, we go into work with the mentality, you know, look, there's a good probability we're going to do CPR today. And I usually set that up by saying, you know, the average person wakes up and doesn't even think about doing CPR. It's not even on their brain, but in the back of their head, it's, I'm probably never going to have to use CPR or perform CPR. And it's true, and it's just two different worlds, and we know that, and we know all about this stuff and how often we do it and things like that. But, yeah, it was a crappy day. There was nothing that could lift me up. The only thing that lifted me up was my kids. I know that sounds cliche, but those of you who have kids, you know exactly what I'm talking about. They're the only ones that were going to lift me up. Only ones. I could play music. I was trying to drown out the voices, everything. You name it, I was trying to drown it, and it was not working. And so I dove into looking up things about survivor's guilt and things of that nature, and there's a website called betterhelp.com. I don't know how reliable they are, but it was one of the first ones that popped up, and they look like they're trying to do some positive work with people. And so I'm going to go with theirs, and their signs and symptoms of it are obsessive thoughts about the event, feelings of hopelessness or helplessness, lack of motivation, difficulty sleeping, headaches or chronic pain, unexplained nausea or stomach aches, flashbacks of the event, social isolation. I can't even talk. That's how exhausted I am. Social isolation. And one of the things they'd mentioned was a chronic stress reaction. But we'll hit on that in just one sec. I wanted to go back over these signs and symptoms. Obsessive thoughts about the event. Now, here's the thing that you guys I know will relate to and typically happens off duty for me, but it did happen a lot on duty as well, and that was the obsessive thoughts about the event. And that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about, though, is if you go back to your area, if you live where you work, it's got to be really tough. But and I have that here where I'm at now because I live now next to the station that I used to work at for fire. And so I can drive around town and be like, oh, yeah, I ran that TC there, and that was a hit and run there. That was an auto ped here, and, you know, there was a GSW here, and that was an execution. And then there was, you know, and just you see those events or you relive those events every time you drive by. And so if we're, I don't know that I would say we have obsessive thoughts about the event, but we're constantly thinking about it because we're constantly there, right? Feelings of hopelessness or helplessness. And I don't know that I've ever felt, well, yeah, I have felt helpless, but I don't have those feelings now. I don't have those feelings later, I guess. I don't know, maybe. It's kind of a weird one for me, but lack of motivation. I don't lack motivation. Difficulty sleeping. I've always had trouble sleeping. No, let me rephrase that. There was a time in my life when I was in the automotive industry and you could drive a Mack truck through my house and I would not wake up. Once I got into EMS and fire, man, a bug could fart on the next block over and I'd hear it. And to combat that, I actually run a fan. I try to find actually noisy fans when I have to buy a new one. I make sure they're noisy because I want that white noise. Maybe they call it brown noise because it's so loud. I don't know. Either way, it's noise that will drown out other noise around me. And it was so bad at EMS when I was on the box that my wife, we lived in this apartment when we first got married, and the bathroom from my bed was maybe 6 to 8 feet from my head to the bathroom where she would get ready. And she would be blow drying her hair, and I slept like a baby with a blow dryer going 6 feet from my head. And people go, there's no way. And I'm like, I'm telling you, because it drowns out all the thoughts in my head and it drowns out all the noises I hear in the neighborhood around me or outside of my house or what have you. And so just crappy sleeping all the time, right? And I don't think that this is necessarily all chronic stuff. I think a lot of this is more acute, but, you know, I'm kind of turning it because we're constantly traumatizing ourselves and we constantly are on this type of roller coaster ride, if you will. And if we're constantly experiencing death and trying to help people, we're constantly losing patients here and there. And that's going to happen, right? But I think it's just these things become chronic for us. Right, not just off of one event, but multiple. So, some of the other unexplained nausea or stomach aches. You know, it's hard to eat healthy on a box. It really is, especially if you don't have a station to go to, or if you do have a station, there's no stove, and you know, things of that nature. And so, I think one, our diet doesn't help. Stress doesn't help your stomachs, and so that's going to be any job, I think. But flashbacks of the event, I've never really had a lot of flashbacks of my events. And if you guys heard my podcast with Daniel from Dan Sun Photos a couple weeks back, none of my nightmares or even flashbacks, really. I don't have flashbacks. I just don't have them. I really don't. Social isolation. I mean, that just, I think that comes with EMS. I think we just, that's just automatic for us. I don't think we have I don't think there's a cause for it other than we just our dislike of people. And I think that's just because we've seen the evil in people. And so I think we're just in that, and we know that, you know, and I said this previous podcast as well, is we live in the world of when, not what if, right? And when is this going to happen? When is that going to happen? And you know, my examples that I usually give to people, especially when I'm teaching, is like, when are airplanes going to fly into the Twin Towers? I know I've used that before. Or, you know, when is there going to be a party or a big concert event and you're going to have a mass shooting, right? Las Vegas or San Bernardino. You know, we see this stuff happening, and in our head, it's not a matter of what if, it's a matter of when. When are we going to run this call? You know, or when is this going to happen? Well, I don't want to be there when it does happen, right? So I think that's where the social isolation comes from. And this now we're kind of transitioning over to that chronic stress reaction, where it typically involves exhaustion, lack of direction, paranoia, and isolation. And that's according to the U.S. Department of Defense. But one thing on here that stuck out, and I didn't mention it yet, I'm going to right now, and that was they stated a lack of humor. I don't know one person in our jobs, whether it be law enforcement, fire, EMS, medical, stuff like that, that deals with these type of trauma stuff, that's not funny. Maybe we got to look at this from an outsider's point of view. I guarantee you, somebody sees some of the posts we put up on social media, they're not going to think we're funny. And they're not. They can't, right? Because the stuff we talk about, our humor, is just horrendous. Years ago, my wife and I and her family were going to Olive Garden. We were going for Mother's Day. I think it was Mother's Day, yeah. And we called it, for lack of a better term, it's called a clan, but it's not a clan. It's we call it a clan because there's so many of us. And usually when we go out, there's like 12, 13 of us. And they're Hispanic. They spend every waking moment together for the most part. And I know I'm generalizing. Just stop. It's humor, you guys, okay? It's humor. What we're talking about. Anyways, so we're going to Olive Garden, and we had 12, 13 of us, right? Maybe more. And as we pull into the parking lot, I can hear sirens. We park, we get out, we meet up, and as we're walking in, AMR rolls up, Rancho Cucamonga Fire rolls up, or was it Ontario? I think it was Ontario Fire rolled up. And they go walking in, and we're sitting there waiting for our table, and as we're waiting, there's a here comes AMR with their gurney, lady on the gurney, husband, and I'm assuming husband, walking in tow, fire's coming out, and I look at my wife, and I look at my mother-in-law, and I go, man, table two just opened up. And it's not even that dark of humor, right? But my mother-in-law found it funny, because she was used to dispatch for a local police department, and she kind of chuckled at it, and my wife just looks at me and goes, did you really? Really? And again, to me, to my mother-in-law, hilarious. Not hilarious. It was funny. It was a good joke, right? It was nothing special, but it was a joke. But yeah, I guess looking at it from an outsider's point of view, we are not funny at all. We are some sick, twisted individuals, right? And we always joke about that, but in reality, we are. But we use that dark humor for our coping mechanism, but people don't see that. All they see is the dark humor, which doesn't translate to being humorous to people who aren't in our industry. It's just you're sick and you're morbid. So, you know, look, poking around, one of the things they were talking about was ways to help yourself, and that is to help others. The problem with what they're talking about is I couldn't find very much for how to heal from it, how to deal with it, other than therapy, right? It pretty much was like, you got to go to therapy. That's it. You got to go. There's a lot of stuff talking about it, but and especially in first responders, but nothing really seems to be like, this is what you could do. And I get it, psychology, but, you know, again, trying to help others. Well, that's what we do for a living. The problem is in our quest to help people, if you will, we're running into more and more people that are hurt, right? We're being called to those things. So it's just, like I said, we're just re-traumatizing ourselves over and over and over again. So what do you do to fix that? You help more people, but then you run into more traumas. So you help more people and you run into more traumas and then you help more people, you know, it's just over and over again, but it's just a vicious cycle. It really is. But really here's the thing. And I've talked about this for years. Well, all right, so here's the thing, right? We always talk about there's only so much we can do for our patients, and there's only so much we can do within our scope. There's only so much we can do with our tools. There's only so much we can do. And within that, there's huge flaws, right? We have huge flaws in our systems. Everybody's system is flawed. You can't, you can message me all you want, but your system has flaws. Your EMS system has flaws. Prime example, no blood for running traumas, major bleed, right? We're still running normal saline. Why? We know this isn't working. I remember as a new EMT going, that doesn't make sense. They're losing blood, so you just give them, you're giving them water? You know, salt water? When they're losing blood? Oh, yeah, you got to balance it out. How do you balance it out if it's draining? Anyways, I mean, look, we're not a rolling trauma center. There's problems, right? And there's only so much, we're limited on what we can do. But even as a trauma center, I worked at a level 2 trauma center. You're still limited on what we can do. Human knowledge, physics, right? I mean, look, MOIs, injury. No matter how you train, no matter how skilled you are, how many resources you have, we can't save everyone. It's impossible. You guys ever run on a ped versus train moving at a good rate of speed? There's nothing to find except fragments. That's it. There's nothing you can do. Anybody ever have to go searching at 2 o'clock in the morning for a decapitated person looking for the head? You can't do anything. Why do you feel guilty leaving that scene? There's nothing you can do. Zero. Nothing. Now, I get it. There are certain calls that are going to just stick with us regardless because we wish we could have been there prior to, or maybe if we had gotten there sooner, you know, we try to reason with ourselves. But let's be honest, man. Somebody gets ran over by a car or a big rig or something, or a semi-truck or something. You're not going to save them. You're 2 minutes sooner, 3 minutes sooner, you still aren't going to be able to stop the trauma, the hemorrhaging, none of it. You can't. It's physically impossible. So why do we feel this way? I think it's just our caring nature. And we can say, oh, we don't care. You do care, and that's why you're in this business. You do. And, okay, maybe you don't care about them, but you care about yourself. Why? Because in order to help yourself, you have to continue to help others. It. Look, here's the one thing I found, right? I've been doing this a long time, and I've been involved with social media for a very long time. In fact, I looked, I found that I want to say the EMS Lounge was found in 2015. I'm pretty sure it was 2015, and I took it over the same year it was found. So, been doing the social media stuff now for 8 years, and every single EMT, paramedic, fireman, cop, nurse, doctor, whatever, every single one online thinks they're the best. They are the best at what they do. And you know how I know? Because they let me know. And they let me know that if I post, because when I post something, and I give some type of info and I can read it from the book, right? People will argue over it for weeks back and forth, getting on me saying you can't do this, but you could do that. And then somebody else will pipe in, no, you can't, because what about this? And then what about that? And what about and everybody tells you, everybody wants to tell everybody else how they did it wrong, right? Which means you're the best at what you do. So if you've ever jumped in and critiqued somebody or slammed somebody for what they did wrong or what they're doing wrong or what they're suggesting is wrong, you feel you're the best at what you do. And if that's the case, look, here's how I put things to myself. It's just like positive affirmations or whatever you want to call it. But I know my skill level in the field was, I'll say it, it was some of the best because of the systems that I worked in. I got to work in the super busy middle of a big city, and I worked that for years. But I also worked in a system where I've had to do CPR for 56 minutes straight from the time I arrived to the time I got to the hospital. Right? I've worked every type of system. I've worked in the desert. I've worked in the city. I've worked rivers. I've worked lakes. I've worked avalanches. The only thing I haven't worked is a tornado or a hurricane. That's about it. About the only things I haven't worked. Okay. Worked in the largest county in the nation, and I got tons of experience doing that. And so my thinking is, okay, I'm good at what I do. I know my skills. I know my protocols. I know my policies. I know what I need to know, and I'm maxed out on what I can do with my skills as far as my skill level, right? That makes sense at all. But if that's the case, then me being there with that person, I'm the best chance they have for survival. That's it. I'm giving them the best chance they have is me being there. And I know it sounds cocky, but that's kind of what I'm talking about. If you guys are able to critique me, then you feel the same way, and you should be feeling that way too, and you should know that you are good at what you do. You've been doing this a long time, and you work hard, and you study, and you did all your CEs, and you keep up in your training, and da-da-da-da-da, then you should know you're one of the best at what you do. In which case, if you can't save them, nobody could. What does that mean? That means it wasn't up to you or I. It was up to God. That's it. That's the only one it mattered to. That was the only one who could change the outcome of this whole situation. And I will always believe that I, because I was there, they had the best chance of survival. And my crews, I know my crews are good. I wouldn't say I handpicked my partners, but on a box, I kind of did, because people would work overtime on my shift. Nobody wanted to work my shift, probably partly because of me. But the other part was, it was early morning in a busy area, in a crappy area, and you got hammered all day long. And some of you guys know what I'm talking about. And if you're listening and you work for Care Ambulance in Southern California, Zone 1, which is L.A., it's nobody wanted that. It was a 6 o'clock car. It was a day car. It means we worked 12-hour shifts. Well, 11 and a half. But you worked 11 and a half hours in one of the worst neighborhoods. And you just got hammered. But we were known as, for a lack of better term, the Cowboys of Care. And I just made that up, but we were, you, if you work Zone 1, you were crazy and or stupid. And that's just the way it was. I don't know if it's still that way, but those of us who've been around and know me and worked with me, you guys know I was a fan of that area because of the cities we ran in, for the stuff we ran, the way we were short-staffed, the way we could be running, you know. There was a 24-hour car in the city of Huntington Park. Man, I worked that thing on a 24 a couple times, and I think the least amount of calls I ever ran was 23. in a 24-hour shift. Like, we would run 26, 28, 32 calls in a 24-hour period. So, and that was just 124, and I think there was six or seven 24s, I think six 24s. And then during the average day, we'd have another 6 to 8 12-hour day cars. It was stupid. Like, it was stupid busy. But that's the thing, is we got tons of experience, but I got to work those areas, and that's why, right? But I know I was able to hone my skills. My skills were dialed. I was good to go, and I gave them every chance. I gave them the best chance. But how do we get over it? I don't know. I wish I had the answer to that. And I don't know that there is just one answer. I think it's different for everybody. For me, it was getting out of it. It was getting away from it. And it's just, you know, and I know Daniel and I were kind of on the same page with this, and it was just that stopping of the traumatizing, the repeated trauma to ourselves and to our brain and to our psyche over and over and over again. We had to stop it, and that's what we did, and that's what worked. And to be honest, that's probably what it's going to take for almost every single first responder. Eventually, we have to stop. And when you talk about trauma, what got you into this business? I think for most of us, we had some type of major trauma as a child. Had a lot. And I think that's the underlying reasons as to why we got into this business. I don't think we want to see anybody get hurt like we did. And when I mean trauma, I don't necessarily just mean an actual physical injury. I'm talking a mental trauma, psych trauma, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, I could go on for, I could do a whole podcast. I could write a book on the trauma in my life and the things that happened to me when I was a kid. And what's funny to me was growing up, and even up until a few years ago, probably until I got into EMS, I got into EMS in my late 20s, early 30s. That's when I started actually working in EMS and fire. And that's when I started to realize that, man, my childhood was not good. I had fun. I enjoyed it. I rode motorcycles, skateboards, bikes. I raced it all. I did all the funny tricks or the fancy tricks on the stuff. And I had a good time. I did a lot of things a lot of kids don't get to do. And I think, again, that's just where I lived and the people I was surrounded by. But when you go back and look at my childhood, and like I said, I could do a book on it, but from early on, physical trauma, mental trauma, by the time I was 2 years old, I had cracked the arch in my foot. My father had left my house and basically abandoned me. I burned my leg with acid that I was supposed to lose the leg, and then they were like, no, he's going to need surgery. He'll never walk normal again. And then, you know, as we move up through time, it's multiple injuries from skateboards and BMX bikes and things like that and motorcycles. I had a major rollover TC when I was 15. My mom remarried and divorced within 2 years. During that time, I was in that rollover TC. I've been divorced. I've been mentally abused by my mom's second husband. I was mentally abused by my mom's third husband. He and I got into physical fist fights, and I was, you know, 15, 16 years old. You know, just things like that. You know, stolen car. Had a car stolen from me, I should say. I didn't steal a car. I had one stolen from me. Just a ton of different things, and I'm leaving a lot out of my life, and I'm just hitting on some key points and just saying, you know, when I used to grow up thinking, man, I had this great life, and, you know, we had this and we had that. But then I look back and I go, man, at one point we had to give our landlord a car because we couldn't afford rent. I had a single pair of shorts. I didn't even own a pair of pants. I had one pair of shorts that were torn because we couldn't afford to buy another pair of pants. I had shoes that were ripped up because I couldn't afford to buy those. We were buying powdered milk for a while because we couldn't buy regular milk. And then it got to the point where we couldn't even buy the powdered milk, you know. And so again, I grew up thinking la 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 is a great time, and it wasn't, right? And so we had enough pain growing up, and I think that's why we got into this industry. We wanted to stop it, right? I know it was for me. That was part of it for me, and I don't really talk about that, and I don't really admit that normally, but writing this out, that's really what it comes down to, is I want to be there to help the people when they need it. That's it, right? And so I'm curious, too. One of the things for me, and it's always been that way, is I never liked bullies. I always stood up to bullies. I still do. And it's gotten me into some sticky situations sometimes. But to me, that is a big part of me, right? And so I'm curious if you guys are. And so if you do, message me. Just go on Instagram or even Facebook, DM me, if you will, and just say, hey, yeah, I'm the same way with the bully thing. I'm just curious. But if you are, you know, if you're bullying online, just stop. Again, if you really are trying to help people out, why do we go online and fight with everybody online? What's the point? You know, I've gotten into that argument with a lot of people of we'll go back and forth and back and forth. And it's like, you know what? We're not going to change each other's mind. I used to do that. And that's how I kind of burned the page before. I burned the page with politics. And I always said I would. I absolutely did. And, you know, and I still do this even with my brother, and we don't talk anymore because of it. But basically, we'd be fighting about something. I'd go, dude, look, I'm not going to convince you. You're not going to convince me. Why are we still arguing? We can put it behind us. We can move on. We can just go about our day and live our lives. Because realistically, nobody online is going to convince you to change your mind. And you're not going to convince theirs. I guarantee it. If it does happen, it's super rare. But it kind of goes, kind of going off track and scrolling out there. But that was just kind of my 2 cents on what happened with that post and how I was feeling. And I don't know, do you guys ever get that way? You ever just be driving along and all of a sudden something hits you in the, you know, in the back of your head and you're like, man. And the thing was, it doesn't happen to me often, like I said, but when it does hit, it hits hard. But there was no event that triggered it. Nothing. Nothing triggered it, unless it was music. Could have been music. But even that, it was music that I listened to all the time. It was just a playlist that I had going on. So I don't know what it was. I don't know if maybe I saw something or heard something or whatever, but something triggered it. So I'm just curious if you guys get triggered that way too. I haven't had one of those days in a really long time. But, yeah, that's all I got for you guys. New stickers coming out. Check it out. It's going to be – I'm trying to get it online, so it's a pre-order. But it is a, what I think is going to end up being the new logo for the lounge. And I just took some old other photos and tweaked them a little bit, but just playing with some Procreate digital stuff and actually found it and fun and enjoyed it and made a little logo out of it. So the sticker's going to go up. By the time you see this, I'm hoping to have it up online. You can actually pre-order it, and then stickers start shipping out probably, well, it's probably about 3 week lead time, and then they'll start shipping out. So that's how long it took me for my last ones. Go online if you want to, theemslounge.com. It'll take you to a Shopify store, and there's a little keychain backboard you can buy, and then there's also just the old logo that's available, decal. Those are, I put them down like $2 a piece because I'm just trying to get rid of them at this point because we're going to change the logo. So if you want to see what the logo looks like, go on Instagram. It's there. It's already up, and you can see what it looks like. So other than that, have a good one. Keep lounging.